Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading stories from the online edition of the Geographic Society today. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, What Was the Scopes Trial? How One Teacher's Arrest Sparked a National Debate. In 1925, a small-town trial became a national spectacle, pitting faith against science. Here's what to know about the lasting legacy of the Scopes Monkey Trial. It's written by Aaron Blakemore. It was published in June 23, 2025. Was Charles Darwin's theory of evolution scientific fact or dangerous anti-Christian heresy? In 1925, one such teacher became a target of a law outlawing teaching evolution in schools, and a central figure in the fight to teach evidence-based science. 24-year-old John T. Scopes didn't remember if he'd actually taught evolution to his high school students in Ray County, Tennessee, which would have been a violation of a 1925 Tennessee law. But that hadn't kept him from volunteering to be accused and ultimately arrested for it. Remembered today as the stuff of legal legend, the so-called Scopes Monkey Trial pitted the scientific belief in evolution against Protestants' belief that Earth and humanity were created by God, and raised questions about educational freedom, scientific inquiry, and evidence-based science that still resonate today. Here's what to know about the explosive trial and its legacy. How a Tennessee law strikes a national debate. Tennessee was one of just several states that tried to ban evolution from school curriculums during the 1920s. They were encouraged by a national anti-evolution movement that had gained steam in previous decades. Religious resistance to science had risen as an avalanche of new discoveries in the 18th and 19th centuries threatened the authority of American Protestants. Many in the church questioned the new theory of natural selection. If humans had evolved instead of being created, then the Bible's account of creation must be inaccurate. This clashed with a growing fundamentalist movement within the church that held the Bible to be literally true, and it worried opponents already grappling with the major societal changes wrought by modernity, urbanism, and the First World War. By the 1920s, national figures like William Jennings Bryan, a popular orator and politician, and popular evangelical radio star Amy Semple McPherson were speaking out against teaching evolution in schools. In response, Tennessee passed the Butler Act in March 1925, named after its sponsor, State Representative John Washington Butler. The law prohibited teaching, quote, the evolution theory in all publicly funded educational institutions in Tennessee, making it unlawful to teach any theory that denies the story of divine creation of man as taught in the Bible. Violators would get a misdemeanor and be fined between $100 and $500 for each offense. Who was John Scopes? Though there was little opposition to the law before its passage, it caught the attention of civil rights activists looking to preserve the separation of church and state. As increasingly Orthodox Protestants sought to extend religious teachings into public school classrooms, opponents tried to keep religion out of public secular schools. Evolution was a stress test for public education, with scientific inquiry colliding with the fear that learning about evolution might destroy organized religion. The new American Civil Liberties Union, first founded to resist wartime checks on free speech, was in search of a test case against anti-evolution statutes it considered to be an unconstitutional violation of religious liberties. We are looking for a Tennessee teacher who is willing to accept our services in testing this law in the courts, wrote Clarence Skinner, one of the ACLU's founding members, in a widely publicized advertisement in 1925. Our lawyers think a friendly test can be arranged without costing a teacher his or her job. The ad and the controversy surrounding evolution sparked the interest of a group of civic boosters from Ray County, Tennessee, in an economically depressed area that had recently experienced a massive population decline. Convinced a controversial trial would boost the region's profile, they met with John T. Scopes, a 24-year-old football coach and part-time high school teacher at Ray Central High School in Dayton. "Although not a trained scholar, I thought Darwin was right," Scopes later wrote in his 1967 memoir. Although he was unsure whether he had taught evolution as a substitute biology teacher, he told these civic boosters that he believed he had helped students review for a final exam that involved the theory. One of them then arrested Scopes, and a trial was set for that summer. Evolution and creationism on trial. The trial pitted the theory of evolution against religion and set the stage for one of the greatest battles in legal history. Clarence Darrow, a high-profile attorney known for his dramatic defenses and massive salary, was to represent Scopes and the ACLU, while Brian agreed to assist the prosecution. The presence of two of the world's most famous men and the explosive subject matter of the debate turned sleepy Dayton into a destination. Reporters and spectators crowded into town, and the trial was covered in breathless detail. It was, in the words of historian Tom Arnold Foster, a fraught national circus that dramatized a series of interlocking cultural conflicts between science and religion, urban and rural, elite and popular, north and south. Every day the trial began with a spoken prayer and an all-male, all-white jury, most of them practicing Christians, listened to the verbal fireworks that accompanied Darrow and Brian's cases. Though a criminal case, much of the defense's testimony revolved around the validity of the theory of evolution, with witnesses stating that evolution was commonly accepted among scientists. Meanwhile, the prosecution's witnesses testified that Scopes had indeed taught evolution. Finally, Darrow made the unusual move to call the prosecution's own counsel as an expert witness on the Bible. Now, Darrow closely questioned Brian himself on matters of theology and science. By then, the case had been moved outdoors in a nod to the stifling summer heat inside the courtroom, and thousands of spectators gathered to see the defense and prosecution tussle. A turning point in the debate over evolution. Grilled on the ins and outs of Genesis, Brian faltered and tripped over his own words, making it clear that he only believed some portions of the creation story were literally true. The examination climaxed with Brian's accusation that Darrow was only there to slur at the Bible, accusing him of atheism and of using the court to spread his anti-Christian ideas. Darrow replied that Brian had fool ideas that no intelligent Christian on earth believes. Brian's testimony was eventually struck from the record after the judge decided it was irrelevant. Finally, Darrow requested that the case be directly sent to the jury, a move that prevented Brian from making a convincing final case. Still, Brian's side prevailed. In less than 10 minutes, the jury decided Scopes was guilty. He was fined $100. Scopes made just one statement during the proceedings. "I feel that I have been convicted of violating an unjust statute," he told the judge after the verdict was passed down. "I will continue in the future, as I have in the past, to oppose this law in any way I can. To act otherwise would compromise his academic freedom," Scopes said. Brian had won the case, but had been publicly humiliated. Just 5 days later, he died of, quote, sudden apoplexy. Though Scopes appealed, the case was eventually dismissed on a technicality. The test case had failed to protect Scopes for possibly having taught evolution, but it carried out its main purpose, to publicize the evolution and education issue and raise awareness of potential conflicts between church and state. Why was it called the Scopes Monkey Trial? Given the massive media interest, the Scopes trial was the first case in American history to be broadcast live on the radio. The technical details of evolution also forced journalists to write more detailed scientific reports. The trial's contested subject matter was also an opportunity for intrepid journalists like the Baltimore Sun's H.L. Mencken. A journalist and free speech advocate, Mencken became the unofficial, often caustic voice of the trial, dubbing the proceedings the Monkey Trial, a nod to the furor over whether humans had descended from monkeys or been created by God. Mencken took aim at Brian and the prosecution, calling Brian out-generaled and out-argued by Darrow. Laws prohibiting teaching evolution would stay on the books for decades more, with Tennessee's law only being repealed in 1967. By then, the Scopes Monkey Trial had become a legal and scientific legend, thanks in part to the 1955 play Inherit the Wind, which portrayed the anti-evolution movement as analogous to McCarthyism. The lasting impact of the Scopes trial. Nor have questions about science's potential to upend religious authority faded in the century since the trial. Today, a broad scientific consensus supports Darwin's idea of evolution by natural selection, and everything from the fossil record to evidence contained in human red blood cells supports the idea that humans evolved from a common ancestor. But the Scopes trial still serves as a symbol of an ongoing struggle between conservatism and progress, religion and secularism, evidence-based science, and scientific misinformation. And that's the end of the article. The title was, "What Was the Scopes Trial? How One Teacher's Arrest Sparked a National Debate," by Aaron Blakemore. The next article is titled, "They Used to Poach This Rare Bird, Now They Save Them." After decades of political unrest, former poachers and community members rallied to protect the Bengal Florican. It's written by Mashumu Basu and was published in July of 2025. During mating season, the male Bengal Florican bird, in glossy black plumes with streaks of white beneath a mottled back, performs aerial leaps as his white wings flare against a neck pouch of puffed black feathers to attract females. The enamored female, draped in buff brown and black, then chooses her mate. Tourists now come to the Manas National Park, a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Assam, India, to see the Bengal florican, the world's rarest bustard, and other wildlife. But the bird's resurgence has been a long and still challenging process. Listed as critically endangered by the IUCN, fewer than 800 Bengal florican survive globally. The world's largest population, between 350 and 400, is in northeastern India today, and part of their recovery is being driven by communities intent on saving these 2-foot-tall, 3- or 4-pound birds. The twist? Many of them once hunted the bustards. I was around 14 or 15 when I began poaching with my friends, says Rustam Busamateri, now 40 of the Bodo tribe, who lives in Kamandawasa village near Manas National Park and its adjacent non-protected grassland in Kokalabari. Busamateri says he and other young poachers once hunted birds, including the Bengal florican, with slingshots and bows and arrows. They consumed the meat, but also sold the surplus for profit. Poverty pushed certain sections of our community to hunt wildlife for survival, he says. From the late 1980s through the early 2000s, a conflict between members of the Bodo ethnic group and the Indian state over the group's autonomy left Manas National Park desolate, devoid of patrols or offices. This meant its wildlife was more at risk than ever, says Busamateri. Bengal florican were poached, but so were other animals like rhinos. When the Bodo movement ended in 2003, about 100 members formed the Manas Mayo Zingdari Ecotourism Society, or MMES, and pushed for change so that the park could regain its former glory. Busamateri was part of this effort to transform poachers into protectors. The MMES began reaching out to villagers, motivating them to become a part of their conservation movement. Local nonprofits such as Aranyak also joined them to discourage hunting. We made them aware of the consequences, such as imprisonment, penalties, and environmental damage, and encouraged them to divert their skills to protection, says Bibhuti Lakkar, Aranyak's grassland expert. Gradually, community members began patrolling voluntarily alongside forest guards, protecting the very wildlife they once hunted. Busamateri notes that the transition was not easy, as poaching was for so long a means of survival. But some nonprofits and wildlife enthusiasts provided essentials, including rations, for a couple of months to help the adjustment. The team's work was also supported by some senior district officials who visited their villages frequently and advised them to surrender their illegal and hunting arms. Today, a growing number of tourists from around the world visit and have the chance to witness the Bengal florican and its legendary dance. And that helps the local economy. According to Busamateri, more than 2,000 families living around the park earn $400 to $450 per month during the florican season, from November through June. The same birds we killed in the past for food are today sustaining our households, Basuma Terry says. Meanwhile, though still critically endangered, the Bengal florican are showing signs of improvement. A 2024 study in the Journal of Threatened Taxa found 10 more of the birds in Manas compared to a 2011 survey, calling the modest increase an encouraging sign. Today, the Bengal florican has become a symbol of our culture, and we are proud in being able to protect the rare bird and show its unique ways to the rest of the world, Basuma Terry says. And that's the end of the article. They used to poach this rare bird, now they save them, by Moshumi Basu. The final article today is titled, This Town on the Thames is Fit for Royalty, but Has So Much More to Offer. It's by Kira Richards, published in July of 2025. The River Thames has long been the lifeblood of Henley. For centuries it welcomed merchant ships carrying wine and grain from London. Trade with the capital transformed it into a thriving port town. Tudor and Georgian townhouses steadily gilding the streets around its medieval marketplace. But it wasn't until 1839 when oars hit the water for the inaugural Henley Regatta that the town made the leap from prosperous port to fashionable resort. Featuring more than 400 races spread out across the first week of July, the boating event now attracts over 300,000 visitors every year, with spectators gathering for riverside picnics at Remenenham Farm, Temple Island, and other vantage points. The regatta remains a key cornerstone of Henley's identity, but with local chefs using British produce to put a spin on dishes inspired by distant cultures, the town is also becoming something of a culinary hotspot. What's the food and drink scene like? January 2025 saw the opening of The Duke, a cozy gastropub a few streets back from the river. All dark wood paneling and plump, striped cushions, it specializes in small plates cooked over open flame grills, with head chef Ryan Honey serving up dishes like lamb shoulder tacos and king prawns with yuzu and jalapeno. Steps from the riverside is Hart Street Tavern, whose breakfast menu includes a hearty full English complete with crispy hash browns. Come evening, you'll find diners tucking into cauliflower popcorn, miso Cornish cod, and punchy tropical cocktails. For supplies, head to the marketplace, which hosts a farmer's market twice a month. Just off it, Pavilion is a cafe and deli stacked with sauces, preserves, and pastas. Grab a specialty coffee from the front counter or book one of its small group cookery classes held in the open kitchen. What else is worth checking out? The Henley Distillery, a multi-award-winning spirits producer based on Hampstead Farm in neighboring Binfield Heath, shouldn't be skipped. Owned and operated by master distiller Jacob Wilson and his family, the site features a tasting room set within a 200-year-old barn. Visitors can sample gins and rums around its curved bar during the distillery tour, or take part in the 3-hour gin-making experience, choosing from almost 100 different botanicals to craft their own blends. For those looking to venture into the surrounding countryside, there's Gray's Court, a 14th-century country manor with Tudor chimneys overlooking the Chiltern Hills. The surrounding grounds feature walled gardens and 2 repurposed outhouses. Seasonal produce is sold in the old woodshed, with the former cow's shed now serving as a tea room. Head back into town to peruse independent shops like Calvert Jones, which stocks cookbooks, handmade jewelry, and luscious potted plants. Or dive into Henley's rich riverside history at the River and Rowing Museum, which houses a collection of boating memorabilia alongside artworks from the likes of Henley local John Piper. And that completes the article, This Town on the Thames is Fit for Royalty, but Has So Much More to Offer. Written by Kira Richards. And that completes the broadcast for today. You have been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I've been reading were published in June and July of 2025. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on the words Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.